In this feed, we sometimes showcase the work of producers who open a new window on history or remind us of what it would be useful now to remember. This piece from The Fishko Files, produced by WNYC, does both. The story starts 100 years ago.
When did humans become truly modern? And what made us that way? A big part of the answer is the Great War. When it ended 100 years ago, a century of shock began.
When a war ends, it never quite ends. It goes on in the heads of people who have experienced it.
It was in their heads, and the impact of it changed everything. Music?
Oh yeah, they'd never heard anything like it.
Visual art?
There is a cynicism that is ferocious.
And how war itself was memorialized.
Something about that structure people responded to, thousands of people.
And the way people themselves were understood.
Sort of throwing down a line between the past and the present.
Not to mention machines. I'm Sarah Fishko. This is Shell Shock 1919, How the Great War Changed Culture. At the start, the prevailing view was that World War I would be over quite soon, in a matter of several weeks, perhaps, or many months at most. The fighting ended 4 years and tens of millions of deaths later. And after a century, we can't stop trying to figure out the war's complicated legacy. We keep digging, looking for lessons.
It is really for all of those who gave their lives, the 116,000 Americans and the million of men from all over the world.
This past June 28th, Americans and Europeans joined to mark 100 years since the day of the signing of the Treaty of Versailles.
That is why the work of remembering, of commemoration, is more important than ever, to remind us that the cost of sleepwalking into catastrophe...
That was the still highly contested document that officially, bureaucratically, ended the war.
But 100 years gives us some time...
The centenary event offered champagne and speculation.
Had there been no Great Depression, had there been no Second World War, then maybe it's easier to look back on the Treaty of Versailles as a great success.
In the Hall of Mirrors, in the Palace of Versailles. Oddly, there had been a kind of naive excitement in some quarters about a world war. The idea of battling things out on a global scale. Men in particular had been asked to think of war as a noble adventure. The feminist movement, which had just begun in earnest in the couple of years before, was already rattling men who felt their place in society was now less clear. The war, some reasoned, might actually help men regain their status in the world. The uniforms, the battles, the songs, the sheer assertiveness of it all.
The war really brought something new into the world.
Philip Blum. His book about post-war life and culture is called Fracture.
Because they said, you know, finally here there's something that gives us certainty, that shows us what we have to believe in, that shows us who our enemy really is.
There was at the time what some call a crisis of masculinity. We tend to think of the rise of women in America in wartime as something unique to World War II.
Where we're talking about Rosie the Riveter and the women going into the aircraft factories.
But something similar happened in World War I, observes David Lubin, author of the book Grand Illusions.
There are many recruitment posters you can see from this era of women with blowtorches and women with pickaxes and women wearing dungarees and farming the fields.
All of which worked to their advantage as women organized toward a constitutional amendment guaranteeing their right to vote. This made them stronger.
They realized that working in the war industries not only was gratifying to them personally, but also would be very difficult to deny the vote to members of the population who'd done so much to sustain the war effort.
Speaking of the war industries, this was, of course, the first truly industrial war. Massive mechanical and chemical weaponry. A modern war of industrial sound and fury. Deaths possible on an unprecedented scale. Its hallmark and legacy was the pervasive illness soldiers began to call shell shock. Its impact resonated in the culture. If there's a well-known dramatized representation of shell shock in the First World War, it would surely be the famous scene in Stanley Kubrick's 1957 film Paths of Glory.
Hello there, soldier. Ready to kill more Germans?
As a commanding officer takes a tour of the trenches.
That is, everything all right, soldier?
All right. Yes, sir, I'm all right.
Good fella. Are you married, soldier?
Married? Me married?
Yes, have you got a wife?
A wife? Have I got a wife?
He's a bit shell-shocked.
I beg your pardon, Sergeant. There is no such thing as shell-shock.
The film tells the story of a disastrous manipulation of a military unit by a general hungry for the glory of battle.
I'm never going to see her again. I'm going to be killed.
Get a grip on yourself. You're acting like a coward.
I am a coward, sir.
Snap out of it, soldier! Sergeant, I want you to arrange for the immediate transfer of this baby out of my regiment. I won't have other brave men contaminated by him.
That scene is true to the reality of the moment.
Carry on, Sergeant.
Because despite Freud's recent pioneering revelations about the human psyche, not everybody believed there could be such a thing, that you could lose control over your body and voice due to repeated episodes of war. In the trenches, just seeing someone in that state could be devastating.
Don't forget, men especially had been educated, boys and men, to be men. That means you don't cry, you don't show weakness, you are hard, you are courageous, you are tough. And then you see these people simply crumbling. And that was not part of the plan. That was not part of their education. Nobody had prepared them for that. The psychological effect of that was quite powerful.
It just wasn't the physical ailment that was visible, a blown away arm or a scar in the abdomen. But it still needed to be treated nonetheless.
The pioneer in this regard was a British psychotherapist, W.H.R. Rivers, of the Craig Lockhart War Hospital in Scotland.
He treated some of the men who had shell shock, including the poet Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen, and came to understand that the suffering, the trauma they were going through was really deeply embedded in the experience of war.
The poet Wilfred Owen, first suffering from shell shock, then killed in action while still in his 20s, left the world some of the earliest World War I creations, haunting poems, evoking the sounds in the trenches. He described the stuttering rifle's rapid rattle and the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells. The shock and violence of the war found its way deep into the culture of the years that followed. It was simply incomprehensible. Even during the war, off the battlefields, people were reeling with a sense of disaster. Some gathered in Zurich, which, due to Switzerland's neutrality, had become a refuge for thinkers, artists, and politicians. It was a time for manifestos and cultural movements, and avant-garde poetry, in some cases. One group had its headquarters in a nightclub called the Cabaret Voltaire. Hugo Ball, a saloon piano player and author, was at the center of the group. We're told the movement called Dada was created December 5, 1916. It started as a cabaret act. Richard Hulzenbeck and Hugo Ball were searching for a stage name for a young woman who was to join them.
A few days before she was supposed to come to the cabaret, I went with him through the Larousse encyclopedia, and there I found the word Dada.
Hulzenbeck reflected on Dada's origins in 1959.
So I said to Ball, why not Dada? And he said, Dada is wooden horse or toy in French.
Turned out the young woman never did show up at the cabaret, but they liked the name, so they kept it.
The word Dada had a kind of a magical attraction, and from now on, we called many of our activities Dada.
What was it exactly?
We didn't know exactly against whom we should turn, but it was very important for us to find a target for our resentment. And we had this great hostility, which we had turned first against the war and against the imperial regime, but finally we generalized in such a way that we attacked conventionalism. The bourgeois was one of our main targets. So I found out what is the bourgeois, and I made the sad discovery that we were all bourgeois. So what was the use to attack the bourgeois when I was a bourgeois myself?
If nothing else, they wanted it to be senseless.
The irrationality of this movement was its essential factor.
The group's confounding statement of purpose was written by artist Hans Arp.
Before Dada da war, war Dada da.
Dada is an old-fashioned, four-legged crossbow that's leading a puppy on a leash. Dada has vibrations that are stronger than 100 jungles. Dada at times resembles a head made of peat with wormy apple eyes. Nevertheless, every day Dada is more beautiful than the previous one.
The Dadaists were not only interested in nonsense, says the Museum of Modern Art's Anne Temkin, they also embraced the idea of chance in art.
Which would include scattering a bunch of torn papers on a surface, as, say, an artist like Hans Arp would do, and gluing them down where they fell. And that idea of chance as a compositional method absolutely remains strong today, 100 years later.
Marcel Duchamp said later, even though your brain might say, there's no such thing as chance, I know what's going to happen. You had to let go of that kind of thinking.
So it's a kind of adoration for chance, or the consideration of chance as a almost a religious element. So it's very interesting to have introduced, to put it at the service of art production.
And Dada embraced contradictions. Tristan Zara of the Dada Group said, in principle, I am against principles. Later, some of the Dadaists got together with the painter Fernand Léger to create the legendary Ballet Mécanique, a silent film with bold editing and shattering juxtapositions, using some violent modernist imagery in response to all that had happened. Léger had been injured as a soldier in World War I, and, like the poet Wilfred Owen, he was especially horrified as he lay ill, listening to the battles play out. He wrote in Letters from the Front about his acoustic fear as he heard artillery fire and detonating shells. It all found its way into that film.
Ballet Mécanique is almost a sort of first wave reaction, because you see, it's the fragmentation of human bodies. It's the mechanical aspect of human bodies. It's the repetitiveness and the meaninglessness. You can see how that in many ways looks at the experience of shell shock.
American composer George Antheil wrote an original score with the same title. For airplane propellers, buzzers, various electronic devices and instruments. Antheil declared his music to be streamlined, glistening, cold, often as musically silent as interplanetary space, and also often as hot as an electric furnace. The highly passionate and influential Dada movement soon turned in another direction, observed the droll and worldly Marcel Duchamp in a TV interview.
When they began, of course, as usual, a group of people don't get together very long. 2 years or 3 years of it was enough, and they began fighting together. They hated each other. So they dispersed and became another group from itself on the ashes of Dada to become the Surrealists.
More later on the Surrealists. But speaking of Duchamp, don't forget 1919 was also the year he drew a mustache on a postcard of the Mona Lisa and embellished the image with the letters L-H-O-O-Q, quite a racy French phrase, suggesting that beneath her enigmatic facade, the Mona Lisa was in a state of overheated desire.
That Dada attack on high art was in some ways actually a life jacket sent out to art.
And Temkin suggests that even 100 years ago, let alone now, the Mona Lisa had already become the equivalent of a poster or a cliché. An eye-rollingly familiar image, now made eye-opening.
By making fun of her, giving her facial hair, making her seem like a racy woman, in a way you could say that rescued the Mona Lisa by defamiliarizing her, by making you blink and do a double take.
Classic Dada, the takedown of high art. It all sounds very clever and lighthearted. The photographer Man Ray, part of the group, thought otherwise when he was interviewed in 1972.
I always have the feeling that the 20s and the 30s and the Dada movement and the Surrealist movement, it was a great deal of fun.
No, not at the time. People just look back to it, there's things in a marvelous period, romantic and all that sort of thing. But no, it was very tense. It was very bitter, and there was no humor in it. But what we did was really to upset things, you know. But subconsciously to clear the way for something new which we didn't know yet what it might be.
As far as I can think of, the Dadaists were the ones who did the most confrontational portrayal of what had happened to civil society in the wartime.
The not knowing quite what they were doing, that was part of it. They wanted to say something, even if it was nothing. It was modern, and it was urgent. So was the memorializing of World War I. It was needed the moment the war ended, and to this day.
I know that they have the puppy day.
A German tourist is visiting the cenotaph, the singular war memorial in Whitehall in London.
They fill it with puppies, and I think the English glorifies their deaths. What else can they glorify at the moment, huh?
This particular memorial has no noble imagery, no soldier on horseback. A stone structure, rectangular in shape, with the words "The Glorious Dead" carved into the stone.
This is fine. This is good. But it doesn't also say from which side, yeah?
The monument is situated oddly in the middle of the street. That is, traffic going both ways around it. But it's hard to overestimate its importance in Britain.
It's part of my growing up. I've seen it on TV since I was a child, so I was literally just passing on business and I thought I'd take a photograph.
Tour groups passing by quite often. In every language.
And it's not just those who fell that worshipped in the Church of England. It is the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims, the Buddhists, the Sikhs. So it is representative of every soul on planet Earth.
Cenotaph is a Greek term, kenos, meaning empty, taphos, meaning tomb, empty tomb. That's an idea that goes back to an old naval tradition, honoring men who went down with ships. World War I historian Dr. Jay Winter puts the cenotaph at the very center of the effort to remember and honor those who fought.
What makes it original is the conversion of a moment of victory into a moment of mourning. This is what's astonishing.
It was modeled after a hastily made papier-mâché structure, which had been temporarily situated in Paris at the far side of the Arc de Triomphe. The British called on the architect Edward Lutyens to create the same kind of thing for them.
And he did it. He did it on the back of an envelope and then built it in papier-mâché again and put it on the mall connecting 10 Downing Street and the Houses of Parliament. So it's right at the heart of official London.
It was intended to last for a week or so, to somehow mark the war's official end and honor the dead.
And what happened is that the people of England voted with their feet that this is the National War Memorial. There were 2 million people who came to London for that victory parade, which wasn't about victory. It was about the dead. It was about the lost generation. And what Lutyens did, which turned the Dean of Westminster and the Dean of St. Paul's, both clergymen, apoplectic, was he made this monument without a cross.
In doing that, he made it, as the war had been, non-denominational, and that proclaimed its universality. As for the level of spontaneous outpouring of shared sorrow, it's something we know about from September 11th, certainly, in the notes and names covering fences in New York, and at Buckingham Palace.
What happened when Princess Diana was killed and so many people dropped flowers and whatever in her memory much later in the 20th century happened then?
It happened almost instantly then, in 1919, at the temporary cenotaph.
It was literally covered in flowers by millions of people who had no idea where their dead son was. And most of them would never have any idea of where he was.
So Lutyens was asked to remake it in stone.
And he did. He replaced it, and it remains there to this day.
A fascinating bit of history, an overwhelming response.
The shock of that loss, the shock of that level of suffering, is something from which Britain has never recovered, and the cenotaph is the symbol of that. It's the moment that divides history, and you can actually see it.
In that historic dividing line, you can see a post-war collaboration of sorts between the artist Lutyens, who made the monument, and the millions of people who desperately needed to use it.
There was this extraordinary, somewhat un-British, outpouring of emotion.
I asked historian Anna Carden Coyne, what was it about the cenotaph then? What did it look like? What did it suggest?
It's an empty tomb. There's nothing in it. Yet it sort of looks like a severed limb. It sort of looks like an invincible superstructure. It has scale and permanency. And it, on one sense, references the absent body. On the other hand, it reforms it. It's sort of eternal and modern at the same time. And it was so successful that it was replicated all over the empire. And you have, even in small towns, you might have a mini cenotaph.
Which is not to say there aren't other deeply moving memorials, too many to mention. In contrast to the cenotaph, one notable one is by the artist Kate Kollwitz. Emma Chambers, a Tate Modern curator for the World War I art exhibit Aftermath, says Kollwitz allowed her own son to go off to war right at the start.
And he was killed in October 1914, and she never forgave herself for having allowed him to go.
Kollwitz's monument is called Grieving Parents, two figures sculpted in gray stone, kneeling, one bent over. They face her son Peter's grave in the Vlodslo German War Cemetery in West Flanders, Belgium. The use of the human figure had returned after the war, following the art world's love affair with abstraction in the pre-war years, 1911, 12, and 13, says Anne Temkin.
One of the phrases that's used often, particularly with French art, is the return to order.
Picasso, for example, let abstraction go for the moment, finding fragmentation less appealing. His monumental human figures of the time were modeled after classical Greek imagery. And Matisse famously traveled to Nice toward the end of the war to make more lyrical work.
But in all of those cases, it's a return to a legible human figuration. It's almost like, wow, all these people blew apart. Let's put some people back together.
There were artists who felt that impulse to put people back together more literally. So many men had been injured and disfigured in the trenches. People encountering the soldiers on the street were seen to faint from shock at the sight of their distorted faces. And fine artists like Anna Coleman Ladd put their personal work on hold. The American artist Ladd had heard that a British sculptor was successfully creating prosthetic faces for soldiers who couldn't be helped by plastic surgery.
She went to the American Red Cross and said, "I think I have the skills to do this as well. Can you set me up in Paris to help soldiers, French soldiers and American soldiers?"
Historian David Lubin says Ladd was funded to set up a studio on the Left Bank.
And pretty soon, the studio was filled with men who had been defaced in the war. And they're really, the French called them les goules cassés, the broken mugs.
And Anna Coleman Ladd sculpted faces for them.
She would take a mold of the man's face as it was. And then, looking at photographs of the man before he was wounded, she would construct a mask to put the nose back in, to put the jaw back in. They would attach it to the man's face by eyeglasses.
In episodes of Boardwalk Empire, the cable series of a few seasons ago, the character Richard Harrow had been seriously injured and disfigured and had returned home from World War I with one of these tailor-made masks. Not an uncommon sight in the period toward the end of the war and after. Presumably made by one artist or another, someone like Ladd.
She also had to give the man a characteristic expression because this was the expression he was always going to wear in public. Maybe at home he'd take his mask off, but when he went out on the streets, this would be his face. So she tried to figure out what was the characteristic look of the man. Her team made about 97 masks before the war was ended and the studio was closed.
An attempt to create, build, and restore might also describe the Bauhaus, the distinguished German design and architecture school founded in 1919. Germany had just been forced to face and accept responsibility for the war, in need of a restorative movement, and in keeping with the moment, the Bauhaus said, "Make something new and write a manifesto." Theirs asserted, "The ultimate aim of all visual arts is the complete building. Together, let us strive for, conceive, and create the new structure of the future." What about this particular movement suggested that a manifesto was necessary? And whose idea was it to make a manifesto?
The Bauhaus Manifesto by Walter Gropius is the first architecture manifesto of a long line of artists' manifestos, of political activists' manifestos.
Marian von Osten is co-creator of the exhibition and book Bauhaus Imaginista.
It came out of a revolutionary moment where artists and architects said, "We want to have a new form of education. We need to intervene in how we are educated."
They wanted to integrate the building process into the culture, with all the arts unified. Their hope was that art could play a new role in society.
We see how provocative that was. And all this is a revolution, I mean, literally a revolution.
After the chaos, a fresh start.
Nothing was clear anymore. So if a generation wants to get rid of the idea of the fathers, the forefathers, if there is no tradition anymore, then you have to reinvent everything.
In America, moving into the 1920s, there was an architectural reinvention going on, a building boom in urban areas, skyscrapers going up, changing the profiles of New York, Chicago, Cincinnati, Detroit, then Seattle and Los Angeles. After the cruel losses of the war, artists couldn't take their eyes off the towering buildings. It was a utopian strain, says the Montclair Art Museum's Gail Stavitsky.
Kind of trying to make a better world. The optimism and energy, but just the whole technological revolution.
No manifesto there, but a name given to a group of artists by critics and observers, the Precisionists. Georgia O'Keeffe fell into that group for a time with a famous series of paintings.
Of skyscrapers and of views of the city from this elevated perspective.
O'Keeffe was in a unique position, painting skyscrapers from a skyscraper, the Shelton Hotel, where she lived in an apartment on the 30th floor. In 1927, some of the artists from that group worked to put together the Machine Age exposition near New York's Steinway Hall on 57th Street. The exhibit mixed the inspiration with the outcome.
And it was just hundreds of machines. And the artwork that was influenced by the machines.
E.B. White wrote in The New Yorker that year that the show combined art with cogs, motorboat propellers, crane valves, insides of pianos. Another kind of mechanical ballet. Dadaism, purism, precisionism, a range from deep anger to that utopian optimism. That range had played out in American popular culture, too. Right after the war,
people were coming back to America with disabilities, with shell shock, with sense of despair and disillusionment. The 20s was an extreme reaction against the austerity measures of the war, where people had to save and scrimp. There was a kind of mass debauchery in America in the 20s.
An individualistic moment.
And a lot of this had to do with a sense of physical perfection.
The desire for an aspiration to physical beauty took on a new life.
Where movie stars now were the reigning authorities in our society. People turned to them for tips on what car to drive and what mouthwash to use, what clothes to wear.
At this point, being beautiful and being an American became one. In the creation of the Miss America pageant, 1921.
And Miss America, I mean, think of the sort of patriotic connotations of that. So the idea was Miss America is not a feminist. She's not a foreign-born person. She's an all-American girl representing all-American values.
In that year, on the boardwalk of Atlantic City, New Jersey, Margaret Gorman was chosen as the most beautiful bathing girl in America. She was 16. In this era of beauty worship, people found plenty of ways to enhance their appearance.
The makeup industry is born at this time and becomes a billion-dollar industry pretty early on.
Makeup czars Helena Rubinstein, Elizabeth Arden, and Charles Revson were all in competition and on the rise in the 20s.
And in a sense, people learned that the masks of World War I really did serve people well if they had been disfigured. Well, what about if you're not disfigured, but you still feel like you can't market yourself properly in society because you're not as handsome as Gary Cooper or Greta Garbo?
Society said you can be if you buy things to improve yourself.
Makeup, plastic surgery, bodybuilding.
And horror films flourished based on much earlier work, such as Frankenstein, first published in 1818, Dracula from 1897.
I mean, these things, these stories, so many of the stories, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hugo goes back into the early 19th century. But after World War I, Hollywood suddenly embraces these stories and retells them, The Phantom of the Opera, which had originally been written in 1909. And we think of the classic horror films of the 20s and 30s. I can't help but wonder if somehow they were a delayed response to the war. sort of manifesting themselves as these fantastical monsters and vampires and werewolves stalking the streets of Hollywood's version of London.
While we're on the subject of bodies, masks, and Hollywood, it's worth mentioning Lon Chaney, who was rising to stardom in 1919 on the basis of his role in the film of that year, The Miracle Man. Chaney was especially adept at playing disfigured or physically compromised characters. And soon he was a megastar, with a gift for becoming unrecognizable through makeup and prosthetics, and with a nickname, The Man of a Thousand Faces, a particularly apt title for this moment.
Yes, Lon Chaney was all of these. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Miracle Man, The Phantom of the Opera.
These masked and twisted figures do seem like characters we somehow needed to see re-examined and redeemed.
But what was the secret Lon Chaney hid behind his thousand faces? What was the mystery in his life?
In later sound versions, they've stayed with us, some with the desired happy endings, such as Charles Laughton's memorable bell ringer and his fight for acceptance by society. So one way or another, throughout the popular culture, the war kind of hung in the air. Even if it may have dropped from public consciousness in the 20s, for example, it always bubbled up, certainly in literature, with a newly modern tone.
Hemingway and John Dos Passos basically recreate the war novel in the mid-20s, and suddenly everywhere there's a real interest in the war again.
A Farewell to Arms was made into not one, but two films.
I'll have a fine home for you when you come back. Say I'll come back to Catherine.
I'll come back to Catherine.
There were the war films and the beauty obsession and Freud, who was a major figure of the time, examining the insides of our psyches with intensity.
The Viennese society, and I do live in Vienna, I know what I'm talking about, is very much a culture of facades.
Author of Fracture, Philip Blum.
And as long as, you know, the outside is perfect, you can do on the inside whatever you like. And Freud was one of the first people to say, well, if that is so, that's going to do something with people. And if they suppress something that they find is unacceptable on the facade, then that is not simply going away, that's going to stay there and work its way through them. Even something that seems on the surface inconsistent or wrong or doesn't seem to make any sense must have a deeper meaning. And it is his role to unearth that deeper meaning.
These principles and techniques, in a somewhat different form, found their way to America by way of Freud's nephew.
His nephew, Edward Eddie Bernays, who was an advertising executive, a public relations specialist, as he called himself, in New York. And after the First World War, industrialists came to him and said, we have a problem. We have increased productivity fantastically because of the war. But now peace has broken out. And what are we going to do if we no longer have customers for our stuff? And Bernays had read his uncle's works. He had never met him, but he had read his uncle. And he said, well, if you want to keep selling stuff, you know, don't sell cars, sell dreams. Don't tell people this is a car that doesn't rust and that goes 100,000 miles and needs very little petrol. Tell them that if you buy this car, you're a real man. And that is the beginning of sort of advertising-driven consumption at a scale that the 19th century had simply not known.
Talk about a revolution. This is a complete shift in the relationship of humans to civilization, a different image of what a person actually is.
Namely, no longer the enlightened image of a sovereign rational being that will make decisions based on facts, but now an instinct-driven being that is a bundle of insecurities and lusts which can be manipulated if you only have the key. That, of course, is something that is still very much at work in our world today.
This view of the human as one whose mind and body are deeply related was coming to light in the early 20th century. Shell shock itself had helped to reveal the connection. Even earlier, in 1899, Freud had written The Interpretation of Dreams, and that too provided a shift in thinking. Among other things, dreams contained inspiration for art. The idea that an artist could access a dream, that the real information was now thought to be inside rather than outside, changed everything. Our friend Marcel Duchamp talked about the transformation in an interview in 1958. His observation was that art up to that point had been what he called retinal.
That is, you look at a painting for what you see, what comes on your retina. You would add nothing intellectual about it, nothing else than the visual side of the painting. Analysis of a painting was absolutely anathema then. You should look and register what your eyes would see. That's why I call them retinal.
Then the shift.
Well, the surrealists did change a bit of that by saying, why should we be only interested in the visual side of a painting? There may be something else to put.
The something else was the dream, the unconscious mind. The surrealists looked to their psyches to put their inner impulses and dreams on canvas. And naturally, they had a manifesto, 1924, written by André Breton. We are still living under the reign of logic, it said. But in this day and age, logical matters are applicable only to solving problems of secondary interest. Freud, Breton wrote, very rightly brought his critical faculties to bear upon the dream. The surrealists, says author David Lubin, were bringing dreams to the surface, in a way.
So the surrealist assumption is that we all walk around with masks all the time, that our face, our characteristic expressions on our face, the way we greet each other, that's a phony aspect, that's a mask that we create for ourselves. The idea of surrealism is to delve beneath the mask.
Film, the most dreamlike of all mediums, was a perfect foil for surrealism. By 1929, Luis Buñuel and Salvador Dalí were teaming up for a surrealist film, or the surrealist film, you might say, the celebrated Un Chien Andalou. Buñuel and Dalí had met on holiday.
We thought of Un Chien Andalou because of the dreams we had.
Buñuel talked about it later.
He dreamt his hand was full of ants. And I dreamt of a knife cutting an eye. He said, we could make a film with that using those irrational elements.
They wrote it in 7 days, and it was funded, said Buñuel, by his mother.
I had a phonograph behind the screen. I played Argentine tangos and Tristan and Isolde. I had my pockets full of stones so that if the audience booed, I could throw them. But it was an extraordinary success. Everyone in Paris was there. Le Corbusier, Picasso, it was a success and I was stunned. So I threw the stones discreetly to the ground.
So it was Freud and the dream, in addition to the war, that provided this chapter of art and anti-art and led to the famous melting clocks and later to the Hitchcock dream sequences in Spellbound and all the rest. The unconscious mind had been liberated for the surrealists to access and use. The inside had come into view post-World War I. It appears to have extended beyond art.
You really have a feeling that here is a building that looks fantastically beautiful and it's got its whole facade simply blown off by this war. And all of a sudden you see all the rooms behind and what's going on in them. People conducting affairs, people running the heating, people in the elegant salons. And you understand that things are not quite like what the facade wanted to make you believe. And I think that was a sensation a lot of people had after the war. That they felt, you know, this is not what we were led to believe, this is not what we were educated for.
By the end of the war, those who had lived through it had been led to believe we had become a new society. Just after the fighting ended in 1918, President Woodrow Wilson suggested in his speech that nations had been drawn together in a combination of moral force that would be irresistible, that we had united in victory over repressive autocratic governments. There were limits, however, to the victory, and America, for one, was still grappling with which people exactly were included in this united society. Ironically, in their years abroad, black soldiers had felt at last they were seen as Americans.
There was a lot of faith in the idea for black men, if we served valiantly, in the war. That will then earn us a place on the national stage.
Historian Emily Bernard edited the book Remember Me to Harlem.
This idea that if we demonstrate that we are citizens, then we will earn that respect back home.
Among the returning soldiers, the head of the celebrated 369th Infantry, soldier and musician James Reese Europe, whose band, known as the Harlem Hellfighters, had created a sensation abroad. Their homecoming was a legendary New York moment, a huge parade celebrating the end of World War I. They started downtown and marched all the way up Fifth Avenue.
And they come back, and it's just, it's a party in the streets of Harlem. And so much hope and faith. And soldiers are walking in the streets, and they're wearing their uniforms.
But after the triumphant march, a violent reaction. The official end of the war in 1919 was met in America by what became known as the Red Summer of 1919, a wave of lynchings and racially motivated riots in cities across the nation, Chicago, Houston, Washington, D.C., Omaha, Tulsa, many others.
Direct pushback. I think a fear of the expression of proud black masculinity was so threatening that it led to black men hanging from trees. And it was a real shock.
The shock resonated in Harlem, where activist and NAACP co-founder W.E.B. Du Bois, with a new toughness, expressed the connection to World War I in a memorable and much-quoted editorial of the day, says David Levering Lewis, who wrote When Harlem Was in Vogue.
We return fighting. We return from fighting. We return to fighting. And by God, we will save America in the same way that we save democracy abroad, or know the reason why. And my goodness, that's a new voice. That's not Dr. Booker T. Washington anymore.
Those were the early words of the Harlem Renaissance Movement, an effort to do nothing less than redefine the black community for all to read, see, hear, and experience. As with women who had played new roles and found new strengths during the war, blacks saw a chance to turn this shocking moment into an opportunity.
Langston Hughes rushed in to publish his The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain.
The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain became the unofficial manifesto of the Harlem Renaissance.
And he said, I want the essence of our people to be propagandized, to be appreciated. Our vitality will be a gift to the country. But let's get out of the drawing rooms and let's get out of the offices of the NAACP. No, let's seek our profile in the street to use the art for real politics.
Art for real politics was the spirit of the time. The movement had been spurred by the Great Migration. Nearly 500,000 blacks had come north by 1915, 1916, followed by more as the First World War's demand for men emptied out factories in the north, which created a huge demand for workers to fill those spots. And it was a challenge for art.
And you have black populations from the Caribbean, from Africa, homegrown African Americans. You know, the artists are working out in their art. What is a common thread? What joins us besides the color of our skin? And it's just fertile ground for black artists, and it has never been seen before.
So the Harlem Renaissance addressed all that in writings by Langston Hughes, by W.E.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston, Wallace Thurman, Nella Larsen. It defined, says Bernard, what was then called the New Negro.
The New Negro represented so much, not only a way of thinking and a way of making art that was supposed to be free of white expectation, but also literally the body. Black writers of the period were writing about a new kind of physical presence.
Redefining the stature and appearance of the community with the elegant and natty W.E.B. Du Bois as a model.
You know, he was very self-conscious about the presentation of black people. And so the corrective measure of the New Negro extended to the optics.
The Harlem Renaissance was an artistic circle, and all around it there was music, and the music and other arts bounced off each other.
I'll make you miserable. Treat us women like
the freedom. I'm thinking of a figure like Gladys Bentley, or Langston Hughes writes about her.
Treat us women like you do.
The kind of atmosphere she could create.
I don't want no man that I got to give my money to.
The boldness of this woman.
Hold me a letter, never nothing but a no.
Bentley was a blues singer, and jazz had also found itself during World War I, and just after, says John Batiste, pianist and bandleader. And it was a magical moment for the form.
And it really represented so much more than just music. It spoke to the national identity and the consciousness of people at the time.
From the late 1800s to around 1917, ragtime was the popular form. Scott Joplin was the king.
If you think about ragtime, ragtime is march music that is put onto the piano, but the of the left hand, that's the tuba and the bass drum in a marching band. And if you hear that's like the flutes and clarinets and the trumpets playing the melody. He's doing all that in just the piano's context, which is really amazing.
A little later, it was that same James Reese Europe of the Harlem Hellfighters, a major figure in the development of jazz, who took the next steps by loosening it up.
There was a level of complete freedom inside of the structure. So that kind of is the transition from march music and ragtime to improvisation and the roots of jazz through Louis Armstrong and others around that time.
With radio just getting started, then jazz exploded.
It's crazy how fast it happened. Things really traveled by word of mouth. If somebody put a record out, when people heard Louis Armstrong's records at Hot 5 and Hot 7, and they heard him playing with King Oliver even, it was just like, what is this?
So, in the wake of the war, art had good reason to be bursting out. Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois shared the belief then that art could be a crucial catalyst.
They said, we're starting out to do something. We're starting out to use the arts for civil rights purposes.
For both of them, there was an understanding that the work they were doing could potentially enable Black progress in the political realm. So art and politics and working out that connection, it's something that continues today.
Art and politics coexisted dramatically in the efforts to build a new Germany as well. Germany's reaction to World War I was necessarily instantaneous in the creation of the Weimar Republic in 1919. The German nation had been ordered by the Treaty of Versailles to pay reparations to the Allied countries. The Kaiser had been forced to abdicate. The images, spirit, philosophy, and sound of Weimar Germany are still very much alive, although the so-called democratic experiment, Germany's first such adventure, would die in the 1930s. Gathering in 1919 in the Weimar Republic, named for the town of Weimar but situated in Berlin, was an unparalleled group of artists, some coming home from the front and working with what was called a new objectivity.
These painters served in World War I, came back broken in their bodies and in their minds and in their hearts, and they wanted to show the viciousness of human nature.
Sabine Rewald, the Metropolitan Museum curator, was responsible for the notable Met show of Weimar art around a decade ago called Glitter and Doom. She says their art was unofficial by choice.
They showed the victims, they showed prostitutes, they showed cripples. Otto Dix was asked to paint a portrait of a German politician, Luther, but Dix refused because he would not paint important politicians. He showed the victims.
Otto Dix was very much a part of the Weimar culture, but he was also a one-off. Because he was unlike his colleagues, Max Beckmann or George Grosz or others, who suffered from nervous breakdowns during the war.
Otto Dix was a very hardened man, and he served on the Eastern Front, he served on the Western Front, and when the war was over, he actually wanted to fight further because he wasn't done yet. It was very unusual. And he painted, when he came back, he painted to let out his anger.
Among his works, a group of almost painfully graphic pictures of men with lost limbs, prosthetic devices, injuries of every kind, done with Dix's frank and satirical style. A card game with a bizarrely patched-together table of players, for example, the Scott players.
It's a horrifying, wonderful image.
Another of this group of Dix pictures, called War Cripples, depicted four men in uniform in various states of extreme disfigurement and damage on a Berlin street, and those works became celebrated.
To be painted by Otto Dix was as sitting for your X-ray, in which all your weak qualities are apparent, and then he also exaggerated them. He, for example, painted a good friend who was a doctor, and that doctor looks as if he is about to murder you. Usually doctors are kind people who sit on your bedside and console you. This one is full of medical equipment that are torture instruments.
So the Weimar style, though very distinctive, was an extension of what the Dadaists had started a few years before. Dada had begun with a kind of nihilistic nonsense approach in response to what they saw as the nonsense of war. The Weimar artists shaped it to reflect their newly formed and out-of-control society in a period noticeably fascinating to us today for its art, music, gender fluidity, and racial mix. Sabine Riewoldt has thought a lot about the Weimar period and the Republic itself. I gave her a quotation by a distinguished English theater critic and writer.
Kenneth Tynan said it was as decadent as any place could be, but also very democratic. It seemed to be moving towards socialism, he said. That would have been ideal, socialism and self-gratification at the same time.
Yes, it would have been ideal, but you see, the Weimar Republic, which was founded in 1919, in a way, did not have an instruction sheet. So you had a lot of politicians who were inexperienced, so they didn't know how to do it. And they had a very good foreign minister, Rathenau, Walter Rathenau. He was killed. Another politician died after 3 years in office. So then you had von Hindenburg, who was a general from the First World War. This old man became the president. You had inexperienced people. And this is not, you would not want to have a republic run by people who don't know how to do it.
The Weimar Republic failed. In fact, it's often been defined by its tragic end. It fell to the Nazis in 1933.
We left in 1933. We had to leave overnight.
The legendary singer and actress Lotte Lenya, who lived and worked in Berlin in those years, talked about it later with Skylar Chapin.
Why overnight?
Otherwise we would be in Auschwitz if we wouldn't have left.
Yeah. You had a friend who
warned us, a famous publisher. We were told he joined the Nazi party in order to be able, in case something drastic would happen, that he could warn all those people to get out of Germany, and that's what happened. He warned us, he warned Brecht, and we all left.
The visual artists were in the same position.
All their paintings were confiscated in 1933. George Grosz went into exile, Otto Dix went into exile. But Otto Dix went into exile somewhere in southern Germany, and he painted landscapes and trees and just horrible paintings. And you would not think it's the same artist. But you see, it is like George Grosz. What propelled him, the anger, was the fluid for his pen. So these artists were good when the anger lasted.
As World War II approached, there would be more fluid for his pen. So maybe that's what happened to art and culture. The link between art and politics was forged once and for all. The violence, the shock, the anger, fluid for all the pens, brushes, instruments, and for the dreams and psyches of all of us, those who make art and create culture, and those who consume it. 100 years later, That history and knowledge may sustain us as we too long for a world that will have its own return to order. You've been listening to Shell Shock 1919, produced at WNYC in New York. Technical director is Edward Haber. Associate producer, Olivia Briley. Editor, Karen Frillman. With help from Terence Mickey in Berlin, Mira Sharma in London, and Frederic Castel in Versailles. And with the voices of Michael Wist as Hans Arp and Alexis Cuadrado as Luis Buñuel. I'm Sarah Fischko.
Sarah produces Fischko Files about 10 feet from me here at WNYC. If you crave fresh takes on cultural history, drop into the Fischko Files podcast for a sound-rich array. We have a link on our website. I'm Brooke Gladstone.